Recording. Okay. Welcome to this talk on dealing with anxiety and uneasiness during the corona. Practical advice. This is my presentation, which I had prepared for a video some weeks ago, which because of technical problems didn't work out. So here are some of my ideas. Obviously, there's more to be said about this very, very important topic at this very, very difficult time. I want to begin by sharing with you a brief anecdote from the Gemara, from the Talmud in Masechet Shabbat on Daf Pei Beis, 82a, the tractate of Shabbat in the Babylonian Talmud. It's a brief story. It's a story between father and son. The father was Rav Huna, and the son was, his son was known as Rabba, the son of Rav Huna. The story obviously took place when Rav Huna was, the parent was older, and the son, Rabba, was a young man, perhaps even a boy. And father said to son, "Why haven't you been attending the classes that are being given by my dear friend Rav Chisda? I have a dear friend who's a great rabbi, and you don't go to his lectures." But the son said, "What am I going to go to his lectures for? All he discusses is mile d'yalma. All he discusses is mundane matters. He talks about things which aren't really Torah. They have nothing to do with religion, spirituality, piety. It's all about mile d'yalma. It's all about just, things in general, etc. Mila diyalma, things of the world, mundane matters." So Rav Huna said to him, "What does he speak to you about? What are these mundane matters? Will he discuss football with you? Does he discuss politics? What does he discuss? He certainly doesn't discuss gossip." So he said, "Well, he talks about personal hygiene. He talks about how to keep oneself clean, how to keep oneself healthy, things that one must do to make sure that one's bodily functions are working properly. So I don't go to the class. I'm not interested in that type of thing." So Rav Huna, the father, said to him, "What? Hu asik b'chaye de ben yosa? He speaks to you about matters of health. Bi'at amrit b'mila d'alma, and you reject it as being merely mundane matters? What? All right, kol shkein, zil legabe. If that's the topic of his lectures, he's talking to you about personal hygiene, about remaining healthy, about what you can do to exercise, etc. Certainly go to his class." This is the story. We see from here, of course, there's only one example among many, that our sages, our Chazal, are very, very much concerned with personal health, certainly in matters of life and death. But even in ordinary matters, health is very, very important. And Rav Chisda gave lectures, Torah lectures about health matters. And Rav Huna encouraged his son, not encouraged, but kind of directed his son to go to those lectures. Our Torah has a lot to teach us about health. I also want to say, and I'll give you some examples in a moment, that the science of health, medical science, mental health, etc., science has a lot to tell us about religious matters, because our religious behavior impacts upon our health in various ways. And this has been proven again and again in the past 20 years or so by advanced medical and psychiatric research. So I want to begin by giving you the overview, which is contained in one verse, one pasuk in the book of Mishlei. In the book of Mishlei, the pasuk reads, it's in Mishlei, Perek Yud Beis, Pasuk Chof Hei, the book of Proverbs, chapter 12, verse 25. And it reads in Hebrew, Da'aga, Belev Ish, if there is concern, worry, Da'aga, often pronounced Daige, if there's worry, anxiety in the heart of a person, yashchena, he should suppress it, he should push it down. V'dovar tov yisamchenu, and good words will make him happy, will reduce the anxiety and bring him toward happiness. So what does this mean, yashchenu? What does it mean he should suppress, he should press down, he should trod down upon his anxiety? How can you do that? So the Gemara in Maseches Yoma, Daf Ayin Hei, said that there's two opinions, Rav Ami and Rav Asi. One says the word Yashchena should be read Yisichena. Yisichena from the word, the phrase Hesech Hadas. It should be removed. Put it out of your mind. Put it out of your mind. You know, just forget about it. Put it away. That's one guideline. You're anxious? Get it off your head. Get it off your head somehow. We'll discuss some ways you can do that. The other one, Rav Ami or Rav Asi, says, no, the thing to do is to yisichena, the word sicha, talk about it to somebody else. Speak about it to another person. So we have, according to Chazal, two things that one can do when there is da'aga b'levish, when there is worry and concern in your heart. One thing you can do is to become distracted, get it out of your mind somehow, and we'll discuss some ways of doing that. And the other thing is to connect to other human beings. Talk to other people about your problem. Let's look at some ways to do both of these strategies. Number one, I want to assure every one of you, myself included, I too am at this very moment in quarantine, having traveled from one place to another, and where I am now, they require a two-week quarantine. And of course, I'm concerned about my own health, the health of my family. And just to share with you a brief personal experience, just before Pesach, on Shabbat HaGadol, a few days before Pesach, a few days before the Seder, my sister, the older of my sisters, I'm the oldest in the family, but she's the oldest after me, and she passed away on that Shabbat of this COVID-19, of the coronavirus. So I know about the anxieties of the illness, of the loss, of the grief firsthand, as so many of us certainly who are listening have experienced the same, and maybe even things much worse than I have gone through recently. But what I want to say to all of you is that just because everybody now is having a hard time, that doesn't mean that your stress doesn't count. Sometimes people will say to you, well, everybody has problems. People have worse problems than you. That doesn't mean that your problems don't count. Your problems matter. They matter to you. It's not true that just because everybody else is suffering, you should feel that you don't have the right to suffer. We're all affected by this. And you have to take your concerns seriously and do to the extent that you can everything you can do, follow all the proper precautions, and follow some of the ideas that I'm going to give to you. One of the first rules that comes to mind is focus on what you can control. One of the major feelings of anxiety that we all have now is we feel a loss of control. We can't control our finances. We can't control our family. If we're stuck home with little children, we can't control them. Focus as much as possible on what you can control. We are faced now with the challenge of uncertainty. No one knows, truly knows, how this coronavirus works, where it came from, how to treat it. Will there or won't there be a vaccine, and when? Do these or those precautions work or not? Are masks good or are masks not good? Should we wear masks in public? How should we distance? How far? Indoors, outdoors, etc. There are guidelines, and experts are trying their best to give us hard facts, but hard facts are particularly hard to come by with this particular virus. And one must realize we're faced with great uncertainty. And uncertainty is a great challenge to all human beings. We like things to be certain. We want to know tomorrow I will wake up, number one. I will breathe, number two. And I'll be able to, it'll be breakfast on the table. I'll be able to daven. I'll be able to go about my business. And now I don't know what tomorrow brings. uncertainty is a great big part of the problem of anxiety, but there are small things and big things in our life that are in our control, and we must focus on them to the extent that we can. Our impulse is to try to make uncertainty more certain, to try to do something about the uncertainty. Let me tell you, that can be very exhausting and very futile. There are certain things, a lot of things right now, that are just out of control. And the more effort we put into trying to control things which are uncertain and basically fundamentally uncertain, we're just knocking our head against a brick wall and we're exhausting ourselves. And ultimately, we won't win. There has to be a certain attitude that we have of acceptance. I accept the reality that I'm in. It's not good, but I have to accept it and search and look for what I can do and do the things that I can do. We can wish that we knew what the future holds, but it's impossible to know what the future holds. Another tip, an important one, is to avoid catastrophic thinking. There's this phrase, to me, it's one of the most distasteful phrases that we have in our common parlance, in our common language. That is, what's the worst case scenario? Well, once we start imagining worst case scenarios, there's no end to how bad we can imagine it to be. As much as possible, avoid catastrophic thinking. Avoid worst case scenarios. Try to take a rational approach. And use the skills that you have. We all have dealt in the past with some type of uncertainty or another. Will I get this job? Will I not get this job? Will this child recover from this particular illness or not? And when? Will the phone work? Will the recorder work? Will the computer work or not? Etc. When we deal with these kinds of uncertainties, we begin to assess risks. Should I go out today or not? Should I take my umbrella or not? Relatively minor choices that we have to make, but we all have skills that we've developed over the years, some more, some less, of how to assess risk. And that's what we have to do at this time. I have to assess risk. I can go out for essential purposes. What's essential to me right now? What's the risk of going out to the supermarket today or whatever, given the latest data, et cetera, given the conditions at that particular supermarket, et cetera. Assessing risk is one way of dealing with uncertainty, with limited results, granted, but with some results. That's the importance of using your skills of assessing risks. It's also extremely important to maintain social connections. Yes, keep social distance physically, but as much as possible, maintain social connections. I personally never used to do this, but now every Erev Shabbos, I have to be recording this on Erev Shabbos, Parshas Pinchas, but I try to call 10 or 12 individuals. Calling on phone, I think, is much better than texting and emailing. Texting and emailing, that's not social connections at all. Zoom, or at least telephone, is a much better way. At least you see a face, at least you hear a voice. Maintain social connections. Call old friends, call an old relative, call some young child or grandchild. Call a student, call your boss, but call your friends. Keep in touch as much as possible. But be realistic, be realistic. It's just so far you wanna go. Sometimes you wanna give a hug or a kiss or at least a good handshake and a presentable visit, and you can't do it. So accept that. That's where the acceptance comes in. There's also new social norms nowadays because of the virus. People keep precautions in different ways. Some are very strict about precautions, some not so sick. What you have to be able to say, if you're stricter than the person who wants to come see you is, and you have strict standards, you want to keep social distance, you want to better meet outdoors and indoors, you want to wear a mask during the meeting, etc. Be courageous enough to say, yes, I'd like to see you, but I'm not comfortable unless you and I both wear masks and we keep social distance and preferably meet outdoors, or whatever the guidelines are, the acceptable guidelines. And I personally am very strict and accept the guidelines. Yes, I realize there's controversy about this or that, but I rule in a case of danger, do whatever people tell you to do, experts tell you to do. If they're wrong, all right, what's the downside? That's my own opinion. And sometimes we feel so much pressure that we feel overwhelmed. It's just too much. I can't handle it. At those moments, a very practical thing to do, and it's quite simple, and that is stop what you're doing. Literally step back. Step back. Step out of the situation physically if possible. And take 5 short breaths. Breathe in through your nose 5 times. A deep breath, exhale. A deep breath, exhale. Do it 5 times. You'd be surprised what that does to your immune system, what that does to your neurological wiring, and what that does to your ability to think clearly and calmly. And ask yourself, am I too overwhelmed? Maybe I just can't handle it right now. Maybe this is something to postpone for another time. Or maybe I need to do something else first. Maybe I have a priority. Maybe there's someone else who I can bring into this picture who can help me with this particular problem that I'm now facing. And from time to time during the day, take a break. There is a myth. A myth is multitasking. There's a myth. I think it's a myth. It's not true. You can't do 2 things at once. Right? Okay, and certainly can't do more than 2 things at once. Multitasking is a myth. I'm guided in this by what I've learned. I always admire during his long lifetime the life, the person, and the teachings of Rav Elyashiv, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, who lived to be well over 100 years old. And it's interesting, he had many bits of advice to give that are not sophisticated Torah thoughts. They're very down to earth. He would study 1 Masechet at a time. When he was learning in Gemara, Maseches, Bava Kamma, that's what he would learn. He would learn it from beginning to end, carefully reviewing, making sure he understood every page slowly. Of course, over time, he didn't have to do it so slowly anymore. But when he was involved in that study, he felt distracted by studying something else. He was not a multitasker. He was a unitasker, but very much involved in the task that he was doing. To the extent that we can, focus on 1 task at a time, but focus on that task with all your heart and all your soul, even if it's a trivial task, certainly if it's an important task. We are not made, we're not wired to multitask. I want to say something about the technique known as mindfulness, mindfulness meditation. There's a lot written about this and taught about this. There are recordings and videos that you can buy teaching you about mindfulness. I studied under a professional psychiatrist who used mindfulness meditation as a technique in psychotherapy and who advocated that all of us learn to use it in our own lives. And really, the elementary rules of mindfulness are quite simple. And here they are. This is something we can all do. Number 1, we can find a place which is quiet and where we can relax. I know it's sometimes very difficult under these conditions. Do your best. Go into a room, close the door behind you. Go into a corner where no one's going to bother you. And just sit and relax. Relax means pay attention to your body, let your muscles relax, stretch if you must, get into a position that's comfortable, and make sure you're physically comfortable. And I prefer, and close your eyes, or even better, put one of these blinders over your eyes so you really can't see. And then allow yourself to become very intentional and thoughtful. What am I thinking right now? Where am I now? How do I feel at this moment? Do I really feel comfortable? Is there a particular part of my body that aches or hurts or itches? Focus on yourself to the extent that you can. Once you're in a relaxed position and comfortable, pick something to focus on. The best thing, the easiest thing to access is focus on your own breath. Pay attention to how you're breathing and perhaps intentionally breathe, as I suggested before, deep breaths, one in and out, inhale, exhale several times. And then when your mind wanders away from the breathing, bring it back. Your mind will wander to all sorts of things, important things, trivial things. Keep bringing it back to what you're focusing on, breath or whatever you choose to focus on. Some people, especially very religious people, focus on a phrase or a pasuk, a verse from the Talmud or from the Chumash or whatever. That's fine too. But keep bringing it back so that you're really focusing on that one thing. And then become aware of the present moment. Make sure you're aware what's happening right now with me, what's happening right now, what do I hear, what do I feel, if your eyes are open, what do I see? And acceptance. Whatever is going on, it's not a matter of, oi, I'm doing it wrong, oi, I gotta do this, but rather accepting. Accepting the meditation, the object of your meditation in the moment, and then letting that go. You can do that for 5 minutes. You can do it, people do it for long periods of time. This mindfulness meditation is simple, simple technique, and it's extremely calming, and helps one deal with one's anxiety in many, many ways. I want to give you several specific techniques which I find useful for myself or for others around me. Number one is doing something active and enjoyable. The number one best thing to do that's active and can be enjoyable once you get used to doing it and overcome your resistance is physical exercise. Walking is still the best. If you can walk outdoors with keeping social distance, that's the best thing to do. I try personally to walk 1 hour each day, but I do it in 20-minute sections. I go outdoors when the conditions allow me to go outdoors and walk for 20 minutes and come back. While I'm walking, I try all sorts of breathing exercises and moving my arms and feet in all sorts of ways that there's no rules as to how you do it, but just make sure your body is moving around 20 minutes at a time, 3 times a day. If you can't go outdoors, you can walk indoors. You can walk indoors. I remember my wife and I were for a time at like a little apartment in a senior citizens residence center, long before we ourselves became senior citizens. And there was an old physician there who every day would just walk up and down the corridor every day just to make sure he had his exercise. So exercise is extremely important. Another thing is art or hobbies. Many people are artistic, even if you're not artistic. Coloring in a coloring book, like a little kid does, can also be extremely calming and anti-anxiety. You're doing yisichena. You're removing the anxiety and you're focusing on red crayon, yellow crayon, blue crayon, let me fill in the blanks, etc. If you're more sophisticated and you can actually draw well or paint well, fine. The most important, or one of the most important tools that we have at our disposal is music. Listening to music, playing music, or singing. The easiest thing, and something almost all of us can do unless you, Chas v'Shalom, have a terrible handicap, is to sing and to sing out loud. To sing out loud. Just by singing, whatever the song is, it could be a holy Hasidic nigun, it could be a phrase from the davening, it could be a poem, it could be a popular song, religious or otherwise, doesn't matter. As long as you're out there doing something, expressing yourself, your mind is on the song, your vocal cords are moving, as you're doing it, you can dance, jump, exercise, whatever with the music, and it's anxiety reducing. Not the answer to all your problems, but it's easy and cost-free way to work on your anxiety. Pets, of course, the use of pets, even fish in an aquarium is a home aquarium is another technique that many people use very, very effectively. There are so-called therapy pets, little puppies, etc., that many people use, and they're extremely helpful in the entire area of reducing anxiety and making a connection to another living creature, if not a human, at least another living creature. We are beset with a problem which came before the coronavirus. We heard of it before we even heard of the coronavirus, and that is social media. All of us, just about all of us, are hooked. We're hooked. We can't live without the iPhone. We watch the news 1,000 times a day. Studies, very recent studies, have proven that the social media is linked with depression and anxiety. If you spend too much time, and almost all the time we spend is too much time, we don't need this information in most cases, is a rise in depression and anxiety since the introduction of the smartphone. There's no question about this. On smartphones and emails is a famous expression, FOMO, FOMO. It stands for fear of missing out. Fear of missing out is no joke. If everything you know about is going to bring you to fear of missing out, oi, I wish I was at this picnic. Oi, I wish I could go to that wedding. Oi, I wish I could see Sam, or I wish I could see Sandra, or whatever. Terrible, terrible. Fear of missing out. We've got to live in general, but certainly at this time, live more in the present and not worry about what you're missing out. We're missing out on a zillion things, of course, now more than usual. But acceptance, acceptance, acceptance. What's real, what's not real. I remember reading somewhere, and I think it was in the writings of Rav Eitam Henkin, Zichrono Levrocha, who was never killed by terrorists along with his wife in the presence of his little children. So a few years ago now. Rav Eitam Henkin was in the process of writing a biography, an academically professional biography about the Chofetz Chaim, the author of the Chofetz Chaim. And he had a conversation that the Chofetz Chaim had with someone, which is published somewhere, where the Chofetz Chaim told this gentleman, you know, I don't read newspapers. I don't read media. I don't read about the news. So the man said to him, well, you are a pious rabbi, and you can be so pious as to not read the newspapers, but I'm not quite there yet. I'm not that pious. So the Chofetz Chaim says it has nothing to do with piety. As you put it in Yiddish, it's not because of frumkeit that I avoid newspapers. But three things I found out about newspapers. Number one, they never tell you good news. Extremely rarely do you see good news on the media. I get a news service report with 20 items every day, the most important items. If there's one of those 20 that's telling me good news, it makes my day, because it's rarely do you hear good news, number one, said the Chofetz Chaim. Number two, often it's not true. Chofetz Chaim lived long before the phrase fake news, but he knew that a lot of the news, and maybe most of it, is just plain not true. I personally know from my own experience in the public eye as an administrator and executive and as a rabbi, etc., that often people would, journalists would write up an event where I was involved, and they wouldn't get it right. They would spell my name wrong. They would have something wrong. It would confuse something at best. And sometimes they would completely distort the event that I had personally witnessed, and they just distorted it intentionally, not intentionally, who knows. But number one, the news is never good in the newspapers, hardly ever. And number two, it's often quite false, so why bother? Number three, said the Chofetz Chaim, I can never do anything about it. Most of the news items we read about, there's nothing we can do about it one way or the other. There's nothing we can do about it. The statistics nowadays are rising terribly with more infections of coronavirus and more fatalities, et cetera, et cetera. Sometimes that statistic is accurate, not always 100%, so who knows how true it is, number one. Number two, it's never good news, hardly ever good news. And number three, What can I do about it anyway? What I can do about it is take care of myself in my limited capacity and take care of the others around me and pray to the Ribono Shel Olam. And here we come to something else that we can do. Because I mentioned that one of the etzos, one of the bits of guidance that the Gemara tells us on the pasuk, Da'oga Belev Ish Yashchena. So one approach is Yisichena. All right, put it out of your mind. And I've given you some ways you can put things out of your mind by music, by art, by exercise, by doing other things, by focusing on one thing at a time, et cetera, et cetera. But what about Yisichena La'acherim? How can we talk to other people? So we can do that. Baruch Hashem, the one blessing, one of the blessings that we have in the midst of this virus is the technical sophistication that we have, that we can talk to each other by telephone, by email, by text, by Zoom, by video, etc., etc. This has been what's the saving grace in this entire terrible, terrible pandemic. We can be in communication with others. Is this type of communication as rewarding as person-to-person physical connection? No, of course not. But it's there, and we can use it to the max, number one. Number two, there are other ways that we can communicate. Other ways that we can communicate. Ways that we don't often think of. One is by keeping a journal, keeping a diary. You know, in the old-fashioned books, you'll see the diary begins, "Dear Diary, today I had, you know, scrambled eggs for breakfast," or whatever. This is a way of communicating. To whom are you communicating? You're communicating to the diary, which is you. The odds are no one else is ever going to care enough to read it. Of course, there are famous diaries throughout history, in Jewish history too, where the message is perpetuated over many, many years, centuries, and generations. But keeping a journal is a therapeutic tool. It's an anxiety reducer, and it's a way of communicating out of yourself. Yes, it's talking to yourself, but it still is talking outside yourself to another aspect of yourself. But there's another type of talking that we can do. And here is where I come to the religious piece of the message. When I first went to graduate school in psychology, which is a long time ago now, I got my PhD 50 years ago, University of Maryland, College Park. At that point in time, when we studied psychology, psychiatry, psychotherapy, mental health, we didn't talk about religion. Religion was at best tolerated. At worst, religion was seen as some type of neurosis. You know, if you really believe in all this nonsense about a supreme being and a creator of the world, and you have to follow certain modes of behavior, and blah, 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 that's nonsense. That's not normal. That's what we were taught, and those of us who were religious, Jewish or otherwise, lived with it. Okay, that's what they think, and I'll go on being religious, although many people, unfortunately, were misled by the secular psychology of that time, of 50 or even 40 or 30 years ago, but it's changed. And now the field of science in general, and the field of psychology and mental health in particular, has begun to realize there is value in religion. There's value in religious behavior. And the value is not just spiritual. The value is physical. Religious people are, in general, healthier and certainly have better mental health than people who are not religious. How do you define religion? How do you find mental health? There's a whole literature about that. I get most of my information from a journal, a peer-reviewed journal of the American Psychological Association called Psychology of Religion and Spirituality. If you're interested in research about the relationship between religion and health and religion and mental health, that's one of the places to go, the Journal of Religion and Spirituality. So they've done all sorts of studies, and they show that religious people tend to be more grateful, and gratitude leads to better mental health. They showed that religious people tend to be better at self-regulation, at self-control, and self-regulation and self-control leads to better health and mental health. There's also an article, a whole series of articles now, about what the field of psychology calls surrender to God. There's in one of the journal articles of the Psychology of Religion and Spirituality. I happen to have it right in front of me as we talk. It happens to be in the May 2012 edition of Psychology of Religion and Spirituality, and it's entitled Surrender to God and Stress, A Possible Link Between Religiosity and Health. And they talk about surrender to God. They define surrender to God in a certain way. I don't like the word surrender, but in our language, this is precisely what we mean by bitochon, by having bitochon, having trust and confidence in a benevolent and omnipotent God. If you're a Jewish person with and believe in the Jewish religion, then no matter what brand of the Jewish religion you ally yourself with, Hasidic, Misnagdic, Sephardic, Ashkenazic, left-wing, right-wing, Orthodox, non-Orthodox, if you're a Jewish person believing in the Jewish religion, you believe in a God who is, number one, omnipotent, all-powerful, and number two, beneficent, benevolent, good. He wants our good. Once you have that God that you can relate to, you have bitochon, and once you have bitochon, you are ahead of the game in terms of reducing anxiety, in terms of reducing stress, in terms of reducing depression, in terms of mental health, and even in terms of physical health. So I want to say one or two points about prayer, because prayer is the way we build our bitachon, the way we build our trust in God, the way we express our trust in God, and the way we gain our trust in God. Number one, As much as possible, when you pray, and you pray from a siddur, you pray with a standard liturgical text, pray aloud, not shouting and yelling, but pray enough so that it reaches your ear, that you hear what you're saying. I'm not talking now from a religious perspective, but from a psychological perspective. If you hear what you're saying, it has an impact upon you neurologically, and that is powerful, a powerful anxiety reducer. When possible and when appropriate, sing. Sing a melody to the prayer. If it's the nusach of that we do with the chazan does, or if it's your own nigun, or your own chant, or whatever, that helps, again, neurologically. It does something to the wiring in your brain. Praying to a God, a supreme being outside yourself, that's communication, and doing so in a way that triggers all sorts of neurological and endocrinological responses in your body, which will reduce the anxiety and the stress. Again, to refer to Rav Elyashiv, Rav Elyashiv used to sing when he was learning, and used to sing while he was davening to himself. And people used to come just to listen to his sweet voice and to hear the melodies that he was singing. But Rav Elyashiv had not only grandchildren and great-grandchildren and great-great-grandchildren, but I understand he lived to see a seventh generation. And when these young people, the Chosam Kala, would come to meet him, they were three generations removed from him, five generations removed from him. He would ask them, "Do you keep the Shulchan Aruch?" So, of course, they would say, to the best of our ability. So he said to them, "Do you sing the psalm, the Kapitel Tehillim, known as Mizmor Lisoda? Every day we say this little psalm, Mizmor Lisoda. We sing in gratitude, right? Bolofon of Benona, we sing to him. And we say, Baruch Hashem, Yolam Chazdo, V'dor V'dor Amunoso. Yibon Shalom's grace is forever." It's a short Kapitel Tehillim. Look in any Siddur, Mizmor Lisoda. So he said, "Do you sing when you daven Mizmor Lisoda every day?" We don't say it on Shabbos. We don't say it on Erev Pesach or on Pesach. There are other times we don't recite that. But most of the days of the year, we recite Mizmor Lisoda. Look at the very beginning, just after Baruch Sheomar, you will see Mizmor Lisoda, Mizmor Litoda. Thank you. In the Shulchan Aruch and Simen Nun Ches, if I'm not mistaken, the Shulchan Aruch says that one should recite this with a nigun. One should sing this with a melody. So he asked them, "You keep Shulchan Aruch? Do you sing Mizmor Lisoda to yourself when you daven, or out loud when you daven to some sort of a melody?" And many people who have studied Shulchan Aruch thoroughly, somehow this has gotten by them, and they have to confess, "No, Zayda, Elta Zayda, Elta Elta Zayda, great 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 grandpa, I'm sorry, I don't. So he said, well, start. That was a good time. You just became a Chosam Kala. You have much to be thankful for. Sing. Right? That's the power of song in prayer. There are other aspects of prayer, and here I come to a conclusion with the words and instructions of the Chafetz Chaim. The Chafetz Chaim was tormented. How can we improve our prayer? How can we daven better? How can we pray to God in a way that's more elevating, that's more spiritual, that's more effective? And he had many, many bits of advice, and here are some of them. Number one, he said, pray from a prayer book. Daven from the Siddur. Don't do it by heart. Look in the Siddur. Look in the Siddur. I think he may have suggested this, or someone else did, that from time to time, change the Siddur that you're using. Don't daven the same old Siddur that you've been using since you're a bat mitzvah boy or bat mitzvah girl. Every once in a while, try a different Siddur. Not necessarily a different nusach. Don't switch from your traditional nusach if you happen to have been born as a Sephardi. Don't suddenly start to daven Ashkenaz or vice versa, etc. There are many, many different sub-nuschaot. But make a different publication. Get one with larger letters, smaller letters. Get one with a little bit of a commentary. Whatever. Just to kind of get some novelty and change, and so it doesn't become rote. But daven from a prayer book. Or even do the Birchat HaMazon from a prayer book. Say, recite every single bracha from a prayer book. I had one of my grandfathers who, when he came out of a bathroom, out of a Bet Akisei, and he would say the bracha Asher Yotzar, he would take out of his pocket a little pamphlet, and he would recite the bracha, although he knew it by heart, believe me, he would recite it from a text. So this way he had better concentration, better distraction from everything that's going on around him. Distraction is part of what we're trying to do to get away from anxiety. And it's extremely effective. Very simple. Pray from the Siddur or the Birchon, the Benchirul, or whatever. The Chafetz Chaim says a few other things. Number one, the Chafetz Chaim encouraged people to pray besides the standard routine prayers which are in the book, or in the Siddur. Pray in your own words. Where he writes it is, it's important sometimes to pray besides the three times a day that we pray normally, to pray a little more, me umka deliba, he writes, from the depth of your heart, in your own language, in Ivrit, in Yiddish, in English, in whatever your language is, French, Spanish, who knows, whatever your language is, and pray and speak to God and tell him what you want and what you're thankful for. And what you'd like to see happen, and get it off your mind. You accomplish both things. Your mesiach das, you're moving your anxiety and your stress from the center of your consciousness, number one. Number two, you're relating to another being. You're relating to Ribono Shel Olam himself. And that's communication. That's part of prayer. And that's one thing to do. Another thing to do. So it's personal prayer, inventing your own personal prayers. It's be the same one you say every day or a different one you say every time, whatever. And do the regular prayers from a prayer book. He also says something very interesting. He says, you know, when we daven only from a prayer book, so we don't really think of what we're going to ask for. We pray every weekday, three times a day, for Shema Koleinu, God, listen to our voice, hear our prayers. Or Rifa'enu, God, heal those who are sick. And sometimes as we're praying that, we say, oh yeah, it says here, Rifa'enu, God, please heal. So we insert a little prayer which says, Yehirat Son, God, please heal, you know, Bela bat Sara, my dear cousin Bela, the daughter of Sarah, or my friend Shmerel ben Yehuda, or whatever. What the Chafetz Chaim says is, and he bases it upon the Pasuk, which we'll read in some weeks now yet, and that is to consider in advance, what am I going to pray for now? I'm about to pray for healing. I'm about to pray in general, Shema Koleinu. What should I pray for this morning? What should I pray for today at Mincha? What should I pray for at Ma'ariv, at Arvit tonight? And go into the prayer with an idea of what you're going to ask for. So beforehand, I'm going to be starting the Shmoneh Esrei soon, the Amidah soon. I'm going to ask God for healing and cure. Let me remember to pray for this person, that person, the other person, etc. Let me remember to do this. So you come into the prayer prepared for the specifics that you're going to plug into the prayer. And these specifics can be done in any language, any form that you want. Chafetz Chaim bases it upon the pasuk of Kechu imochem devarim v'shuvu el Hashem. Take words with you when you approach, when you return to God. Come prepared with a pekel, with a little notebook or a little note. This is what I'm going to be praying for today. And plug those words in wherever they're appropriate. If you need a job, make sure that you ask for it for God, but come in advance knowing when I say Borech Aleinu today, I'm going to say to God, Ribono Shel Olam, I need a Shana Tova. I need a salary. I need employment. I need to be able to afford to be a good Jew, which costs some money. I need these things. And have that in mind. We can write it out if that's better for you. And be careful to do this beforehand on your way to shul or wherever, so when you come to shul and you say the words have more meaningful, are more meaningful, and you can insert in the words, in Borech Aleinu, in Refaeinu, in Shema Koleinu, you may insert words in English and Greek and Chinese and Yiddish and whatever language you wish into the prayers. Right? Prayer is more effective and it's a way of communicating outside yourself, etc. I want to conclude by saying one caution. Of course, anxiety is a great problem. And all the techniques that I've mentioned and many, many more will help. However, there is such a thing, of course, when anxiety becomes a clinical problem. It becomes an illness and when professional help is required. When do I know that professional help is required? And by the way, there are systems now, this is true in Israel, though it's true in the United States, of telehealth, where many, many medical professionals don't even require an office visit. They will talk to you. These are medical doctors, psychiatrists, psychologists, social workers, counselors of all types, telehealth, on Zoom or on these other techniques that there are to communicate. So these are things to do. If you find that you can't sleep, that is a loss of appetite, that you're ruminating, you're thinking over and over and over and over and over again about the same thing and can't break that habit, there is help available, solution-focused help. Help that's not going to ask you to change your whole life, but just to change what's bothering you right now and make use of the professional help that is available, particularly nowadays through telehealth techniques. Ask your doctor, ask around, ask your health professionals for referrals to people who can do this competently and effectively when necessary. But when you're not ill, when you don't need professional help, there are many things to do, practical things to do. I shared some of them with you. I wish you luck. I wish the whole world a refuah shleima, yitz Hashem, that we see a resolution to this entire machla, this entire magefa, as soon as possible, so that we can go not back to normal, but to a better normal, to a normal which will be physically, medically, spiritually, religiously, and nationally a better normal world. Thank you very much.